Good morning, everyone, and thank you for dialing into today's Scientific Methods Panel Subgroup Number 3 follow-up call. We'll start off today with some brief housekeeping items and roll call before we dive back into the measure discussion. So for subgroup members, we resent an email that went out last week containing your SurveyMonkey link and the discussion guide. So if you'd like to pull up that email from this morning, it should have everything you need for today's call. Last week, we discussed two measures slated for discussion, 2539 and 3508. And today, we'll use this time to discuss the remaining two measures, 3511 and 3513. And we will briefly be revisiting 2539 as well. As a friendly reminder, this is a public call. Developer representatives are on the line to answer any questions from NQS staff or from the methods panel members, but there are no opportunities for public comment. So with that, we'll do a brief roll call. Do we have Christy Teaglin on the line? Karen Johnson-Maddox?
Hello?
Hi, Karen. Thanks for joining. Susan White?
I'm here.
Ron Walters?
I'm here.
Jen Perloff?
Hi, I'm here.
Great. And Jack Needleman?
Yeah.
Wonderful. All right, so I'm going to turn it over to Ashley Wilbon.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thanks, Miranda, for that and getting us started. So as Miranda mentioned, we are going to pick up where we left off with the cost measures, 35, 11, and 13. We'll dive back into those. And we are going to revisit briefly 25, 39. If you recall, that was the colonoscopy readmissions measure. And we just wanted to briefly bring that back, you know, after we debriefed as a team on some of the discussion with the specifically with the reliability, we did want to bring that back and redirect the methods panel to re-vote on the reliability as it is in the submission form or the testing form currently. With all the confusion with the projected three-year scores and kind of all the back and forth, and as we really kind of sat back and digested everything that happened, it would require significant changes to the submission form beyond what we would allow at this point in the process. So my apologies for, misdirecting in terms of what the methods panel should have been voting on. It was a misstep in process, and so we're taking this opportunity to correct that. And so what we'd like to do is to just bring the committee or bring the methods panel kind of back to that reliability discussion and refocus in on those kind of that discussion around the one-year and three-year data and clarify exactly what is in the submission form. We will give the developers an opportunity to clarify anything just so that we're all starting from ground zero on that discussion, and then we'll have you re-vote. We don't need to rehash everything, but, we've only got a few minutes slated for this discussion, but just wanted to give everyone a little bit of background on why we're back here. We don't like to rehash and bring stuff back unless we absolutely have to. We did want to make sure that we clarified the process for that. So at this point, if you want to kind of focus in on page 3 of your discussion guide, we will focus in on that reliability section again. And in my review of the measure information form and of the testing form, in terms of the specifications that are presented, there is no detail in the measure information form specifically about the measurement period, which I look for in the denominator details, but we should be directed by what is in the testing form. and what they have submitted in terms of the data that was tested for reliability, which appears to be only 1 year of data from 2017, and then the 3 years of projected data. So with that, I did want to give the developers an opportunity. I believe they are on the line to just clarify that and make sure that the methods panel understands what was done for the testing as is represented in the testing form, and then we'll give the methods panel an opportunity to ask any clarifying questions and have any discussion as needed.
Hi, this is Craig Brzezinski at Yale. Good morning. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, yeah, hi.
Yes, we can hear you.
I believe that you characterized our form correctly. We have 1 year of data that is represented in there, and then 3 years that we projected based on assumptions of what the data would look like if we use 3 years of data. And so I won't bring up anything outside of that per the direction, but I will say that 1 year of data does produce reliability estimates that are considered moderate to high consistently in the literature across several different articles that present kind of ranges for these types of things. There is no general consensus in the literature about what is moderate versus low versus high, but in general, or anything above 0.6 or around 0.6 is considered moderate in the literature, and generally it shifts up from there to high, and the ranges where it turns to high varies. And so we do still believe that even though we projected 3 years of data, that even 1 year of data signifies moderate to high reliability. So I will leave it at that.
Thank you, Craig. So at this point, I just wanted to give the methods panel again an opportunity to ask any questions or offer any comments based on that.
No questions.
Would you guys be ready to re-vote at this point? Or I know we had quite a bit of discussion on the last call, and any questions on process or, you know, anything that you would need to discuss before submitting a vote again for that, for this measure on reliability?
This is Susan. I have a quick process question just on voting in general.
Sure.
We're voting on reliability only, but in the SurveyMonkey, it gives us the opportunity to vote on both. So do we just not select anything for validity?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, it's a silly process question, but I just was curious. Thank you.
No, it's a good one. Thank you.
So I would like to clarify this, Ron. I would like to clarify again. This is what you said, but I want to make sure. So the data we're presented is 1 year data with a 3 year projection, and the data on 1 year, we have the numbers we have. We are voting on the 1 year standalone, regardless of what the measure says, or the 3 year projection as discussed numerous times. So clarify again exactly which reliability measure we are voting on.
So you're voting on the 1 year, so that
one year.
Was from actual data. Your vote on the 3 years of projected data, I know there was some discussion on the last call about the comfort level of projected data versus actual data, which is kind of what sent us into that that other track. So the idea is that you're voting on exactly what's in front of you and your evaluation of what the 3 year projected data would tell you. But essentially, I would just clarify that the 1 year of data is of actual data. So that's what you're voting on.
Got it. Thank you.
Actually, this is Jack Engelman. I'm sitting here in China at the moment.
Thank you for your diligence in joining.
Can you remind me where the SurveyMonkey link is in all the materials we've gotten?
Yes, I believe that Miranda resent an email this morning, so it would be kind of at the top of your email. Miranda, I'll let you give the details on that.
Sure. I sent it out maybe 10 minutes before the start of this call, but Jack, I can forward it directly to you now.
Okay, Chris, the email I've got says SurveyMonkey link below, and I am just not seeing a SurveyMonkey link below. Ah, got it. Never mind. We're good.
Okay, so if we're good on that, I think sounds like everyone is submitting their votes at this point on reliability for 2539, and we can move on to the cost measures. So I'll give a couple seconds for you guys to finish submitting your votes if you're doing that, and just give a quick recap of where I believe we left off in terms of the cost measure discussion, and then we'll dive back in. So with 35, we finished voting for liability and validity for 3508, which was the episode for elective PCI. There were some concerns, particularly with the low reliability scores at the clinician level or the 10 MPI level. And there was some discussion, I know Jack offered that commentary on thresholds that should be considered by the panel in terms of the Adams paper and other literature that's out there. In terms of, a low signal-to-noise ratio and where that cutoff might potentially be in terms of the methods panel's evaluations for these measures. And then there was a discussion on validity as well. The developer did submit information for both base validity as well as empirical validity. We had some extensive discussion on NQF requirements for base validity, and we clarified that what was submitted by the developers for face validity did not meet NQF requirements for face validity. It was not a systematic evaluation of the validity of the measure, which put the focus of the discussion in terms of validity on the empirical validity. And the committee had, the methods panel had some discussion on that as well, and expressed some concerns about that approach and whether or not it actually demonstrated validity, and whether the association with the other measures of high resource or cost was in some sense kind of validating the measure against itself. And so, with that, I'll just kind of pause and see if there's any other kind of summary comments based on our review last week, and mainly because I think some of those issues will carry into our evaluation of the last two measures, and so to the extent that we want to kind of highlight any of those overarching issues now would be a good time, and then we can kind of dive into each of the measures individually. So I'll pause there and open it up to any others for comments before we dive into 3511.
The one thing I would point out just for ourselves to be careful about is the difference between the performance and behavior of a procedure episode. So when there's a surgery, the variance should be tighter, and it's a bit more sort of well-behaved. We have a couple of condition episodes. I think pneumonia is one of the ones. Yeah, that's 3513. So anyway, just, will behave very differently when you look at different types of episodes. Just something to keep in mind as you're reviewing the results. And I think the developers add in an external data source for some of the condition episodes. So they're comparing to, I'm not remembering off the top of my head, but there's a third sort of validity piece that comes into play by comparing to an outside data source. That's just one nuance. Not all of the measures got that. Let me look up the data sources.
Thanks, Jen. I appreciate that, and I'll do the same. You're right. There were some nuances with the validity for those.
It was pneumonia specifically. Yeah, and I'll look up what the data source is.
Okay. So while she's doing that, let me just give a quick overview of 3511. It is a measure of episode-based costs for revascularization of lower extremity chronic critical limb ischemia. It also includes services based on that are clinically related to the attributed clinician's role in managing care during the 30 days prior to the event through 90 days after the trigger. Beneficiaries who were eligible or enrolled for Medicare Parts A and B are included. And so for this measure, it's stratified into five subgroups based on kind of location and complexity of the procedure. So endovascular, above knee endovascular, below knee endovascular, above and below knee open, above knee and open, and then below knee. And so, again, they have an explanation of why they selected these various stratification groups there for you. They did risk adjustment again with HCCs, but there are no social risk factors included based on the results of their empirical analysis. And for reliability, which is where we'll start, there was consensus not reached based on the preliminary analysis by methods panel subgroup. There were three moderate votes and three low votes. And again, there was concerns with the movement between quintiles, as well as the the kind of threshold for low reliability signal-to-noise scores at the 10 NPI level. And let's see, there were also, in terms of the concerns with the significant movement between quintiles, again, concerns with the application of this measure for value-based purchasing and how that might affect payments or rewards for within programs. And so I'll pause there and see if there are any other additions to that list in terms of concerns for the reliability for this measure and for other comments from the methods panel.
Okay, so this is Jack, I guess I will start looking for the exact reliability from the signal to noise estimate here. The
741, I think.
The reliability in the 10 on average is above that 0.7 that Adams tested and
right.
Said in a strict split, low, not low, 20%, it was 20% misclassification. The standard for the 10 NPI falls below that, which would suggest, going to Adams analysis, even more misclassification. The test retest correlation is close to the level that my recollection of the literature here, and I can't say I've gone back and checked, is a test-retest correlation of 0.8 sort of is at least one source that I have seen the split between when you can use it for individual classification and when you can't. And this one falls below that.
Yeah.
If you look at the testing form, and you look at the impact of this in the quintiles, as sort of the, evidence of, you know, what level of misclassification one can see at the 10 MPI level, only half, less than half of the group that's classified in the lowest quintile in one sample is classified in the lowest quintile in the second, and about a quarter are classified in the extreme, the top three quintiles away from that on the for those that were classified in the highest quintile, 57% wind up being classified in the highest quintile, with roughly 18-20% in that lowest three. This one, if you go to just the 10 level, the numbers are somewhat comparable, perhaps a shade better, but not much. To me, this one is right on the border of where I would say is the, you know, I don't expect perfection in these measures. There's going to be a certain level of misclassification. But this one is on the border and on the wrong side of the border for me, for enough reliability to be used, where people are getting paid.
Right.
Misclassification of, you know, what looks like 2, 3, 4, 5 deciles, very likely, and on a 10 decile distribution score for the payment. That just feels a little high.
This is Ron. I understand everything you said. That's why I asked the question on Friday about how literal we should be about the Adams classification. And then we talked about previously purpose of the measure. And it is very hard to divorce the measure from the purpose of the measure. And I think that's a separate discussion. I do understand the variation in quintile. I think that's a very valid point that on test retest you should not dramatically switch your quintiles and have a high reliability. So I will ponder that and consider switching from moderate to low. Consider it.
Hi, this is Ashley from AQF. I did just want to, based on Ron's comment about the use of the measure, I think, you know, the measure will not necessarily be endorsed specifically for use in the MIPS program, although we do have some contact and background information that this measure may be used there. But endorsement is for accountability purposes. So for that broad kind of category of accountability, I think that should be in the consideration in terms of how the measure could be used and for what type of accountability program. You know, it's not being specifically endorsed for MIPS, but for accountability.
Well, and that's why, sorry, this is Ronnie, that's why I worded it the way I did, is it's almost like, that again goes on my list of feedback to give to the steering committees, that almost exactly what Jack said, this is a borderline measure for accountability, and if it's used in a payment program, serious reconsideration should be given. But I don't know, you know, when measures come to the, well, this measure will go to the clinician's work group, I'm sure. How does the workflow accommodate that emphasis on utilization and purpose? And I don't know how to do that other than just in the recommendations back. As Jack said, it's right on the border there for just plain old measurement. It's not that bad.
I would, again, just, you know, encourage you guys to kind of consider your ratings for reliability and validity in the context of accountability, which I think is fair game. In terms of kind of process going forward, if the measure makes it past the methods panel and the clinical tests, the committee will have an opportunity to kind of weigh in as a whole on the measure, and they will be applying the use and usability criteria, in which that will be, there will be some level of discussion there as well. So
yeah,
hopefully that's helpful.
But it does seem like it pushes towards the conservative estimation, right? If it can be used in a broad range of ways, in some sense, we have to think about payment, for example, the most sort of risky use or the most impactful use as the minimum in our minds. That's how I would solve that dilemma.
This is Sreen Agavarapu from Acumen. Could I actually offer a couple clarifications on the discussion so far?
Sure. Go ahead, Sreen.
Thanks. The first thing I wanted to make sure to note was for the quintile shift analysis, we briefly discussed this last time, but this for the procedural measures is using 1 year of data and doing the split half testing. The implication of that is that if there's a provider that in a given calendar year for the purposes of a value-based purchasing program has 60 episodes. Here in this table, it's almost as if we're looking at 30 episodes for them. And so in the context of this discussion about how the measures are going to be used, I think the quintile rank shift tables are not at all indicative of how the measures will actually be used. Because in essence, you can think about it as taking a provider who has X number of episodes and the precision that comes with that, and then dividing that by two in terms of the number of episodes and then the implications of that for precision. So I would say that the quintile rank shift table is not giving you an indication of how this would actually be used in the measure and in any program. The second clarification is about the correlations. We just submitted the correlation information as a supplement to the more conventional reliability metric with the comparison of the between variance and between plus within variance that you all saw. And so we just submitted Pearson correlations. I should note that often measure developers, when they're relying solely on that metric, will use an intra-class correlation coefficient, typically ICC21 from Trout and Slice. And the calculation of that would differ from the Pearson correlation in general. And so I just want to make sure that the Pearson correlation isn't being interpreted in a way that is comparable to what other measure developers may submit in terms of ICC21 for those sorts of comparisons across time. And then the final point is in terms of how these measures are actually going to be used, CMS in the past has considered for measures whether both a TIN and TIN NPI version should be available, and has made decisions in the past to make only a TIN version of a measure available for use in a value-based purchasing program like MIPS. And so I would encourage that if the consideration is about the use of these measures in accountability programs or value-based purchasing programs, that the fact of thinking of the TIN and TIN NPI measure as separate is extremely useful because in practice those considerations are taken into account by CMS. I'll stop there.
So this is Susan. I just have a couple of comments on that. So whether it's TIN or TIN NPI, I think the relevant statistic is the minimum sample size that would be allowed. And so, you know, the that before someone would be eligible for measurement. And I can appreciate the impact of the split half and the quintiles. And what I would encourage or encourage the measure developer and other measure developers to do is to present the data. So if this represents a floor of 30 instead of a floor of 60, for instance, and that's not the case here, but it's just an example, to explicitly express that would be very helpful for the committee. But I don't think we have the option of sort of bifurcating this into 10 and approving 10, not approving 10 NPI or something like that. I think we have to take the measure as submitted, is my understanding. But maybe I should just state that as a question and not a statement.
Yes, Susan, this is Ashley. That's correct. And I just wanted to point out that the measure as submitted is submitted for two levels of analysis, which is both the individual clinician, which would be the 10 NPI, and then the clinician group. So both of those should be taken into consideration based on the measure as specified.
And Susan, one quick note. For the case minimum question, the implication of that we have in mind is that for the TIN level of the measures, the distribution of number of cases will be substantially different than for 10 NPIs. And so that's what we have in mind, that it may be the case that, let's say, there's solo practitioner TINs that have a small number of cases that sort of function like 10 NPIs in the saying, but there'll be a substantial portion of the distribution that lies with sort of systematically higher number of cases than for the 10 NPI measure.
Right, and so the minimum for the measure should potentially be higher than, I'm not sure if this one is 10 or 20.
This one's 10.
Yeah. And so I think what we're saying is one way this measure could overall be strengthened is by having a higher minimum case requirement.
Exactly. Yeah, the 10 NPI is kind of irrelevant to us. What's more relevant, I think, at least in my mind, is what are you setting as the floor? However you get to that floor is an implementation. So.
Yeah, this is wrong. I like how this has evolved over time, whereas we went from just wanting to see the deciles, and many of the measures that they've gone on have given us that information distribution. But I think now we're on another matter, which is very important, and Jack brought it up, is if the volumes are low enough that they affect the test retest, the measure developer should provide that information and or have a larger number or a higher minimum for the test retest. I really would like to see that, because then it would take care of the discussion that we're having right now.
We have Jack again.
And just, I'm staring at the quintiles table, and while the sample sizes may be larger in the 10 than the 10 NPI, the distributions are awfully similar, which suggests that may just be the inherent variability of the measure. But it is a little disturbing to go through all this documentation and be told the documentation doesn't really tell you what you think it tells you about reliability, because that's what we're trying to make sense of here. If the issue is that I think the committee is actually going to have to go back and make some decisions about whether we're prepared, and remember it's us, whether we're prepared to standardize some recommendations here based upon what we've seen and observed across a number of different things. I'm happy to apply a committee-adopted set of standards here for reliability. Right now, we're moving our way towards that. We each have to exercise our own judgment, and as we talk to one another, collective judgment. But if what the developer's saying is, you know, you've only got half the cases that you would see in the actual world here, I'd be just as happy seeing test retest with two, you know, sample with replacement models of the appropriate size for each unit. We'd get the same kind of distribution of variance as we get randomly splitting, and we'd get the right sample sizes for the measures. But that's not what we've got in front of us, and that's not the basis on which we can decide. And what we've got to decide on is the data that's been provided to us. And this doesn't look like a terribly stable nation.
I don't want to push too soon, but are you guys, do you feel like you're at a point where you would be ready to vote on reliability at this point for this measure?
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Let's go ahead and do that. And then while you're doing that, I would like to just revisit again this issue for validity for this measure, which was scored at moderate, but in looking at the submission form again, in response to Jen's initial comment on kind of the nuances between the measures, I was double checking to see what additional empirical validity testing was submitted, and I believe for this measure it was very similar to the measure 3508 in terms of the base validity and then the empirical validity with the comparison of the ratio of the observed to expected spending.
Yes.
So I wanted to see whether or not the discussion for the last measure would warrant a revote on validity for this measure as well. Just to hear your thoughts on that.
I think the answer is yes because of the face validity clarification we got last time. That may have driven many of us have been a significant portion of our rating, and that's now sort of off the table. So that changes the equation for me.
Well, it forces you to use the empiric validity as being sufficient enough that you don't, you're not concerned with the face validity. That's what it does. That was the discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. This one is 35.
And this is Sri from Acumen. I know last time there was a discussion of the empirical validity and the use of the claims-based measures to examine correlations and stratification. The thing that I want to emphasize is that we're not testing the data element validity by using claims-based measures. So we definitely appreciate that you wouldn't want to test the reliability or validity of claims data elements using claims data. Instead, what we're doing is testing the empirical validity and sort of the construct validity of the measure. And we reviewed past NQF endorsed measures and a series of claims-based NQF endorsed measures all use comparisons to claims-based metrics. So examples are the total cost of care and total resource use measures. Earlier a point was made about examining the correlation with an external measure, with MSPD. I think that examination is exactly analogous to the sorts of correlations that we're showing in the testing submission for the revascularization measure. And the reason I say that is that the MSPD measure itself is a claims-based measure. In fact, it'll include the exact same claims as other measures, other cost measures. So I think what we'd like to focus on in the empirical validity section is really thinking about this question of clinically, if there are certain high cost events that we can identify, whether through identifying readmissions or complications and so on, versus events that are a more normal course of care, is the measure actually reflecting that? And for the revascularization measure, we've shown the correlations that you see, but the correlations with MSPB or any other metric, even if you had a correlation with a readmission metric, those are claims-based metrics that are examining the same sort of concept. And just as a quick supplement to what was submitted in the testing form, Dr. Sandhu here will walk through for revascularization additional correlations along this line very quickly that could be useful for your consideration.
Thank you, Sri. So with revascularization, as she was mentioning, in addition to showing that episodes of downstream readmission and post-acute care are associated with higher costs, we looked at different clinical categories of costs and showed that a number of complications that are complications or additional costs that clinically we know are important with regards to efficiency were also associated with clinician performance. So amputation-related services, complications related to bleeding, renal injury, infection, repeat revascularization, wound care services, those are four different categories which fairly consistently increased as we go from clinicians that were high performing on the measure with low costs to clinicians that were low performing with high costs. So even though that the largest absolute driver of cost in clinician performance was the cost of the initial revascularization, all of these other areas that we know are important drivers of clinical care and cost for this procedure were all higher in the worst performing clinicians. And I think that really does support the construct validity, and it's similar to what we saw with other measures. We also looked at that same correlation of these complications with the clinician's average patient risk, and we saw that those were also positively correlated. So in our risk model, clinicians taking care of patients that we found were more sick also ended up having higher costs related to these different complications, which I think is also supportive. And kind of a third point related to that to just briefly bring up is we compared the reliability of our measures to a very similar measure that didn't include any service assignment. So a measure that's very similarly constructed to prior NQF-endorsed episode cost measures that included all costs over a given window. And we almost universally found that the service assignment and the inclusion of costs that our 22 clinical experts selected specifically for revascularization improved the reliability of the measure at both the TIN and the TIN NPI levels. Thank you.
So this is Jen. Two quick reactions to that. One, I would love a world where you could validate claims with claims. I call it validity light, and trust me, I'm guilty of torturing the claims data as much as possible for validation purposes. But just the hypothesis test that would impress me the most would be to pick a sequelae or complication that we know is possible, but that is actually a low-cost event, and to look at the difference between episodes, cases that had known low-cost sequelae and known high-cost sequelae. So you're always showing us that high-cost things we know are going to cost more, but, our more nuanced measure is able to differentiate between the high-cost and the low-cost events. So just a thought or kind of comment based on my own experience working in the episode space. But, again, all of what you just described is very helpful.
Just as a quick response to that, we've identified for revascularization specifically one analysis of your point.
So for example, a low-cost clinician with an average cost of $16,500 compared to a high-cost clinician with an average cost of $25,800, wound care services are definitely increased in the high-cost clinicians, but definitely not driving the difference, with it being only $400 in low cost and $800 in high cost. And similarly, there's rare neurologic and bleeding complications, which are $350 in the low-cost clinician and linearly increases to $460 in the high-cost clinician. So these are complications or services that are definitely not driving the overall episode cost, but are correlated and associated with the performance across other areas.
Right, but I'm interested in the case level, not the provider level, right?
And I'm actually now confused because the documentation says that these correlations and the looking at expected to observe where there were episodes with PACs or episodes of specifically speaks to episodes, not clinicians.
Right. Okay.
And yet
right.
in the last couple of discussions of this, you've talked about it as though it's a comparison of clinician, high-cost clinicians versus lower-cost clinicians, and then high-cost episodes versus low-cost episodes.
Yep. We wanted to provide supplementary evidence based on people's interest in thinking about the measures as used in the program. And so the numbers that Dr. Sandhu provided focused on the measure scores because of that interest.
Now, again, the documentation says you're looking at observed to expected at the episode level. A few moments ago, you were talking expected at the clinician level, averaging across all the clinicians' cases.
That's right.
That's not what your documentation says.
Right. This is Ashley. I think this is kind of where confusion erupts oftentimes is that, you know, the methods panel has spent time evaluating and looking at the materials as submitted. And while I think it's helpful context sometimes to hear other analysis that's been done, it's very difficult to analyze and assess information on the fly like this, which is why we don't allow kind of this additional information at this point in the process. So I just want to refocus the committee or the panel on what's in the submission form because that is where the basis of the vote should be focused. So, I don't want to kind of allow kind of a conversation that is going to introduce more confusion into the actual basis of the evaluation. So, Jack, your characterization is correct.
Thank you.
Yes, and this is Ron for the white paper writers out there. Think issues keep coming up that maybe should be addressed for the future as far as the claims versus claims validation and episode provider relationship for measures. Anyway, that's a different issue.
And a good point, though.
They are.
And if it would be helpful, Ashley, we could send the sort of information that we just discussed for consideration. I know that may not be in line with the procedure, but we wanted to offer that because we think it is important.
So again, at this point in the process, I mean, if folks are interested in seeing that information as kind of informational, it wouldn't be used in terms of evaluation of the measure at this point. And so we can maybe discuss offline how that would be most useful.
I have all I need to vote, Ms. Ron.
Okay. Are others ready to vote as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. Go ahead and vote, and give me a second to queue up the next measure. which will be 35-13 for simple pneumonia with hospitalization. So this measure, the simple pneumonia with hospitalization cost measure, looks at the clinician's risk-adjusted costs for beneficiaries who receive treatment for this an inpatient episode. And again, the measure is based on a trigger for the attributed clinician's role in managing the care for the 30 days prior to the clinical event through the hospitalization, and includes Medicare beneficiaries enrolled in Medicare Parts A and B during the performance period. Again, this measure is also stratified into three subgroups, simple pneumonia with hospitalization without complication or comorbidity, simple pneumonia with hospitalization with complication or morbidity, and simple pneumonia with hospitalization with major complication or comorbidity. And again, there's details around how those stratified subgroups are defined and triggered. This measure for reliability actually received a low rating, and so we won't rehash that, but we do need to adjudicate the consensus not reached for the validity. The ratings for validity were 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, and 0 insufficient. So that's, again, consensus not reached.
Low reliability.
Score? Yeah.
That's low reliability for the rating of validity, I can tell you that.
Yeah, exactly. We fail.
Right. similar issues, but this measure was one, for Jen's comment earlier, that there was some additional information submitted along the lines of comparing the pneumonia measure scores to the Medicare spending per Benny measure. And so, there was face validity, which did not meet NQF requirements. The similar validity, empirical validity testing around correlation with hospital admissions and post-acute care, looking at the observed to expected costs. And then also, again, this comparison to the Medicare spending per Benny measure. So with that, I will open it up to the methods panel for discussion for validity in this measure.
I think this has all the same issues as 3511. My bigger question, this is Susan, by the way, sorry. But my bigger question I don't even want to ask is that now that we know the face validity doesn't, I'm assuming that the measure developer did the same validity testing for all the cost metrics, and we're only discussing a few of them. So I don't know how we should address that with the other metrics, since we have sort of this new information that face validity. I don't want to open that bag of worms, but I just am going to lay it out there.
You did.
Yeah, sorry.
So it's a good point. This is Ashley. So the plan is and is to kind of get through these two measures, and then, as is the process with all of our calls, we have the opportunity to pull measures either at staff or methods panel discretion that were not identified for discussion. So that would include measures that passed or didn't pass or what have you. So there will be an opportunity to do that. And so we can revisit those three measures and decide whether or not there needs to be a reconsideration of the validity for those as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Susan.
It's happy to help.
So, just to kind of cue this up again, is there any additional discussion that you feel is needed for validity on this measure based on the kind of the different the additional kind of type of validity testing that was submitted for the Medicare Medicare spending per Benny measure? Or do you feel like this is analogous to close enough to the other empirical testing that it all kind of goes together?
I will. The developer was good to point out that the MSPB measure is claims-based. It's a broader spending measure. So it's not like you went and got hospital or delivery system cost data. It's not an external source.
And I should note that if we had sort of hospital or delivery system cost data, that would be measuring a different concept than the concept that CMS is interested in. When you say cost here, we're thinking standardized allowed amount. So this is cost to the Medicare trust fund, including beneficiary co-payments, which could differ very systematically just based on our own analyses of charges and cost reports at the hospital level from any sorts of costs that are reported by hospitals. So that's the reason that we avoided any sort of comparison to hospital reported charges or costs.
Okay, I'll amend it. Commercial claims data. I got you though.
So, do you feel ready to vote on validity at this point for 3513?
I am.
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead and submit your vote. And let's kind of regroup here. There were three other cost measures that passed with either high or moderate reliability and validity scores. The cataract 3509, cataract removal with intraocular lens implantation, 3510 was the screening surveillance colonoscopy, and 3512 was knee arthroplasty. So we do, within this discussion guide, have a summary of those measures. I can tell you what page here in just a second. If someone gets to it sooner, you can let us know. Okay, page 15 has measure 3509, which is the cataract removal and lens implantation measure. And so I think just to make sure I'm hearing the panel here, it seems like the overarching concern here is validity, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so what we can do if the panel is in agreement with this is to have an opportunity for a discussion if you feel it's needed, and then a revote on validity for these three measures. Does that sound... accurate? It's again, to recap, there isn't the detail in these summaries that we had in the measures that were for discussion because they passed, but essentially there was the same testing submitted in terms of, or same information submitted in terms of testing for validity for each of these measures. So, again, the discussion is, do you need additional discussion for validity at the individual measure level for each of these, or would you be ready to vote?
Since the method was consistent, I'm not sure there's – I'll leave it up to everyone else, but I think I'm ready to vote.
So are you just opening these up for revote in case people think that the misinterpretation of faith validity was driving their vote?
I'm sorry, who's speaking?
I'm sorry, this is Karen. So you're just opening up for revote to make sure that we all understood the faith validity issue, basically?
Yes. Well, I think the concern is that the concern was that the votes for those measures were also submitted based on the understanding that faith validity was adequate. And given that that is now off the table, the consideration, the discussion that has happened around the other methods of empirical validity testing that were submitted, there have been several concerns raised about that, and that would give, by revoting on validity, it would give folks an opportunity to cast their votes based on the criteria and what was actually submitted for empirical validity.
Got it. I don't see any need to continue to discuss it unless someone thinks that there's a different mechanism within these measures than we've already covered.
I'm fine with that.
Okay. So let me have you guys go ahead just on validity, and to the point earlier, you don't need to re-vote on reliability for each of these measures. It would just be the validity criterion for 3509, 3510, and 3512. Okay. So with that done, I think that completes our evaluation for these measures. So we will collate all of the votes, and we will follow up with the methods panel as well as the developers with final votes and next steps as soon as we have had an opportunity to review that and summarize the votes for all the measures that were discussed by the subgroup. Any final thoughts for either recommendations for the developer going forward or questions about the next steps? Okay, hearing none. I just have one other question.
Wait. Sorry, Ashley. It's Jack. Just
okay.
First, it's 9, 10, and 12 we're voting on validity. But I just want to say one thing which I said earlier in this process about the work that Acumen had done for CMS here, which is I think they've actually done a very good job on this. The work to build consensus in the provider community about what should be counted and what shouldn't is commendable, even if we're not just basing things on faith validity. They have looked for ways to provide empirical comfort that the measure is doing what it should do, which is measure high use of resources. The reliability issue has been largely one of degree of variance within the individual clinicians, and partly driven by sample size, but also driven by inherent variability. And while they have been aggressive in serving CMS to try to argue that virtually all levels of tested reliability meet the standards, and we don't necessarily share that, the actual analysis of the reliability has provided a high level of information for us. We suggested ways to improve it, But they've done a good job, and I don't think the votes for or against endorsement in terms of reliability, validity, are intended to impugn the work that they've done.
Agreed.
I think that's such a great point, and I want to point out that this might be a somewhat impossible task, right? This notion that a resource, an episode-based resource use measure is fully valid and reliable on its own may not be scientifically possible. So we can't blame sort of the developers for that potential underlying problem. You may need to group episodes and have composites, for example. So anyway, just to that point, I do think that what was presented was wonderful in revealing exactly what was here.
This is Karen. I'd agree with that. I particularly appreciated the opportunity to be able to actually see what was going into the model, being able to actually look and see what the coefficients were on things like dual status. For example, we didn't talk about socioeconomic status because it wasn't in the discussion guide, but that's obviously what I always look at. I very much appreciated all the information. I actually think these measures, with the exception of some of the ones that didn't pass, that the reliability is quite low, I found them to be quite thoughtfully constructed, and for many of them, I'm not changing my vote of moderate validity, even absent the face validity testing, because I did think that the comparison to other claims-based measures is reasonable. I mean, in this case, we know that what they're measuring is the claims, so the correlating it with something else, to me, doesn't actually change that what they're measuring is fundamentally the claims. Whether or not you think that's reflective of quality, I think, is an issue for the content committees. I'm not sure that I think in all these cases it's a reflection of quality, but I echo everyone's sentiments in saying that the amount of information presented and the way in which it was presented, I think, is terrific.
Thank you all for that feedback, and hopefully I think there were a lot of really great suggestions from the methods panel members as well to the developers. So I appreciate your input throughout this process, and hopefully the developers found that helpful, and we'll continue to work with them going forward for further additional measure submissions. So thank you for that. I did also just want to throw out a quick request for the methods panel members. I've been jotting down some of the higher level issues that came up in this on these discussions that maybe we will want to tee up for discussion with the larger group. If there are things that you noted, I know I've got kind of the claims versus claims validation, kind of the reliability thresholds as a couple of the points. But if there are other kind of broad issues that you identified or kind of that came up through this evaluation, if you could just shoot us a quick email with a bulleted, a few words kind of bulleting out what the issue was, I think that would be super helpful. We're preparing for the in-person meeting, as well as I think one webinar before that in-person meeting. I think it would help us kind of have a sense of what how we might address some of these larger issues going forward and seeing what guidance we can put forward as the full methods panel can put together going forward for developers. So if you have time to do that today, that would be awesome. And once again, just want to thank you for your time and your thoroughness in reviewing these measures. We understand that it's a lot of material. It's complex information, and you guys did a great job working through it. So thank you very much. If you have any other questions or concerns that arise, feel free to reach out to us. And we will be in touch.
Excellent. Thank you. And thank you, NQF, for juggling like 800 things at once.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Have a good day. We're done an hour early. All right.
Yay.
Nice work.
All right. Bye.
Bye.